The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And joined now by someone who I first met because he served me years and years ago at Canoe, one of the best, one of the brightest, and making some killer wine from both Oregon and South Africa, and I believe Prince Edward County. Will Predham is here. Will, thanks so much for doing the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Let's jump ahead. I'm going to jump all over the place with you.
You guide me.
It was fantastic. When I was at Canoe and you were working that night, this was years ago, mm-hmm. and I was immediately just impressed with just your manner and just the job of the Somme is to make things more comfortable. And my favorite moment was you told me that a group once brought in a magnum of yellowtail, mm-hmm. and you did not charge corkage. You're like, all right, well, knock yourself out. I'm wondering, do you remember that story or some of your crazy moments at Canoe?
Yeah, that was a good one right there. I mean, it was during the Winterlicious program, mm-hmm. if I recall. And these are times where people who don't normally get to go out and dine at a place like Canoe, because it's quite expensive, it's quite exclusive, have the opportunity to have a prefix menu.
Yeah,
we always had a corkage policy there. No problem. You can bring whatever you want. Special occasions. We had so many special occasion people. It's, of course, we want you to enjoy that special occasion wine, right?
Yeah.
We can cook all the way around it. So during this program, we occasionally have people who are trying to game the system, so to speak. And this one table brought in a magnum of yellowtail, thinking that this would be the, they just won. They got an even better deal at Canoe. And at this moment, it was very important to them. And I remember and I recall I grew up, wine was not my calling until I was 20. But before that, I remember thinking, okay, I didn't have a lot of money and I didn't have, and I wanted an experience. So it was kind of like, for you, please enjoy on us. And it really made their day. And there was no negative to that whole situation at all. Yeah, the restaurant lost out on a couple bucks right there. But in the end, it was a pretty solid service scenario. I don't regret that moment at all. It was kind of fun. It was good hospitality, I guess.
Yeah, and it was a little thing, but for them, it probably, it helped make their night. And you're right, Canoe is expensive, but it's damn good. And
you get what you pay for it, too.
You get what you pay for it. Who knows? They might have told their friends, and maybe, the old shampoo commercial where they told their friends, or maybe someone else came to Canoe, because of that story.
It's kind of good karma in the end, right? But we had those opportunities at that restaurant to, look at it from a hospitality perspective. And that's, that's one of the major things that I've been able to take away from my six-year tenure in that company and with that restaurant was putting hospitality into context and applying it, truly applying it. And then that just really helped to open up a lot of other doors.
And so, and people forget this. When a lot of people think sommelier, wine geek, or just there's a elitism or all these other things. But really, the two main jobs of the Somme, one is to make the restaurant money because rent, mortgage, kids, all that. But the other side is for the customer is your job is hospitality. It's your job is to make sure their evening is mm-hmm. goes as well as possible.
It goes hand in hand though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as a sommelier or as a wine director or whatever it is for a restaurant, you are in charge of a revenue stream, right? Managing that whole thing. It's not just walking around tasting wines and that's the fun thing that everyone sees. That's the tip of the iceberg, but it's the 90% below that make it work. And you can apply both of them actively and make it both a profitable, positive experience, which again allows for additional experiences and more revenue coming through. It's a matter of mindset, right? It's not a good model to be a great, business person, manager without the ability to follow through on the hospitality side, right? If this was a negative experience, we would then lose revenue. It's kind of counterintuitive. So if you're good at your job on the front, making people feel comfortable, it's going to work on the back end, keeping the revenue coming.
What was it like? Take me to when you were 14 years old, working in a high volume restaurant in Windsor at 14. What did that feel like?
14 was, so I, you know, I started working quite young, you know, paper out and so on and so forth. But there was something culturally cool about this particular restaurant at the time. You know, I'm quite young. I don't know much about dining, but in the Windsor scene, which is a very blue collar, it was a great upbringing. Loved coming from there. It's my home. I haven't been there for quite some time. But at the time, they had this place called Jose's Noodle Factory, right? And it's perfect for that environment. It's family-centric. You have pasta, pizza. This is like 1995, 1996, right? And this is the place where you throw the peanut shells on the ground, right? So I remember my parents taking me there and going like, this is the coolest place ever.
Yeah.
And then wanting to make my own money always and wanting to be independent has been fundamental. I stood in line for a job when they were opening the new location. I rode my bike, lined up for 2 hours prior. I was probably sixth or seventh in line. And by the time I left, there were about 200 people in line. I just shook my head and said, well, that's not going anywhere. I'm 15, 14 with no experience. And I got a call back the next day. It was intimidating. I was terrible at my job for a good 9 months.
Yeah. You should have been terrible at that age.
Should have been terrible. Well, yeah, to a degree. But, like, I mean, should have been faster on the uptake. The one thing that they couldn't take away and couldn't let me go for is that I was dedicated.
Yeah.
So despite how bad I was, and then one day it clicked, and you know, I earned the respect of my peers and earned some self-respect and started to, you know, build a career in the restaurant. I just kind of drank the Kool-Aid and it started to work. So hospitality in restaurants, despite the fact it's been nearly 6 years since I've been in them full time, it is fundamentally part of my DNA.
Do you miss it?
I don't, and I do. It's funny, yesterday, I was at a cool pizza restaurant in Burlington, of all places, called Son of a Peach. And I'd never been there before, and I walked in, I looked around, and it reminded me of the pizza places that I'd go to when I was a kid. Windsor has some of the best pizza in the world that no one knows about. And I said to myself, you know what? If I ever do a restaurant, it will be a pizza place.
Yeah.
And it's been years since I even thought about getting into that, and it's going to be years before I even probably implement it, but it's something that'll be an itch to scratch someday. But right now I'm enjoying so much of what I'm able to do at this time.
Well, I want to talk all about that. Pierce Predham Wines, the website npwines.com.
Yep.
There's also predham.ca, which is your event company.
Yep.
So there's a lot to get to. Let's talk about the wines. South Africa and Oregon. I tried your Syrah Cinsault blend the other day. I've certainly had your Chenin Blanc plenty of times. On this podcast with Jay Onright from SportsCenter on TSN.
Yeah, I saw that.
We enjoyed the single vineyard Pinot from Willamette Valley. Why South Africa and Oregon?
Cool. Okay, so
it's a big question.
No, I
know you can't get the whole answer, but what are the features about that?
To paraphrase, distill it down. I went to this event called Pinot Camp in 2011.
Yeah.
And it's as interesting and fun as it sounds. Most of the time, if I say Pinot Camp, people are like, that sounds like a camp I'd like to go to. And it's an Oregon-based camp. They send in 200 people from around the world, all involved in the trade. No media, no consumers, right? So it's all sommeliers, buyers from all places all over. And you go on this three-day intensive tour of Oregon. I was grateful to be invited, and it's a really hard ticket to kind of get invited to. And I didn't know what to expect other than I knew I was going to be drinking Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris that I couldn't really find here in Ontario in a reasonable price point. So it changed my whole perspective on things, the way that it did everything, the topography, the geology, the people, and of course the wines. Came back and I was buying for Canoe at the time. The wines that I could get, I would buy and we would sell through them almost immediately and I wouldn't be able to get any more again. The next year, I went to South Africa on a competition called the Sommelier Cup. Happens every 3 years. We're actually doing it right now. And it's 13 countries from around the world gathering in South Africa to do a competition. And it's a sommelier exam-style competition after a week of immersion. And South Africa was a place that I never thought I'd go to. It was never really on my radar. And I'm like, oh, well, let's go. How else am I going to get to this place? It's super far away, right?
Yeah.
when I landed there, I fell immediately in love. I couldn't believe the energy in the area, and the wines that we tried were nothing like the wines that were being exported to Canada. They were fresh, vibrant, delicious, accessible, really youthful. Like there's this amazing vibe going on. So this happened kind of concurrent, Oregon and then South Africa. I came back and I was transitioning out of my position at Canoe and starting my own business, which was, who knew what it was going to be. But Nick Pearson, myself, we were friends. I was buying from him for the 10 years that I was at, or 6 years that I was at Canoe. And we decided to start a négociant business to augment our own. Nick has his wine agency, Nick Pierce Wines, which is an amazing portfolio of hand-selected stuff. He lived in France, and we got along super well. We liked the same stuff. He went to Pinot Camp as well, got equally engaged. So we said, well, let's build our own brand with a winery there. We knew enough people, and we went, and we'd taste and make our own along with these amazingly talented winemakers that really knew how to make it. And we did the same thing in South Africa like a year later, where we worked with Radford Dale and blended. Basically, we're blending from their parcels selections specifically for Ontario. These wines are available for trade, meaning restaurants and private clients. We don't have any available at the LCBO. We make a very small amount, relatively speaking. And because of my hospitality background, I want them to go to the places that, you know, really sustained me for the years, which is restaurants. We want to give them a good tool to use of interesting, amazing, great value juice that their customers can go and enjoy and hopefully bring them back, right? But that's generally where it was. It was a need in the market, or at least no one knew there was a need in the market, so we said, let's do this.
Yeah.
And it started from that. We started with like 50 cases, I think, of Pinot Noir, and we were super anxious about that because it's like, who knows?
Were you nervous? Like, oh, when 100%. You first released it, you know, like, I hope people like it. Like when you, like a director going to a movie on the opening night, you know, with the crowd, they want people to laugh 100%. Or cry.
There's a lot resting on it. Like, I mean, I was transitioning out of a role where I had a significant place in the sommelier community at the time, right? And that has transitioned out into a different role now. But for the period that of that transition right there, you're putting yourself on the line. We're putting our name on the thing. And it actually started
right there on the bottle.
Yeah, right on the bottle. And this is something very personal, right? And the only thing that we could really ask from our colleagues and peers is that they try it. You know, it's not like leveraging what you know, it's like, here, you got to buy it because you're my friend. It's never something like that. It was very kind of, here, you know, please try this out. If it works for you, great. And we've seen some really great response. We don't price very high,
you know,
to our detriment, frankly. But this is, this is our passion project. We both have, you know, Nick has his wine agency. I have my production agency. It's like, this is the fun thing we get to do. So we're not going to mess with that.
Yeah. You mentioned, and by the way, before we continue, for people listening, how do they get your wine?
You go through npwines.com.
That's right.
They'll deliver anywhere in Ontario. To your door, which is great. That would be the best way to go about it. It's the simplest and easiest way.
And it's an easy website to remember, npwines.com.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate that for sure.
You're taking the time. And I've bought from you guys, and you know, I've always been a big fan of the juice you guys do. Now, you mentioned early in the South Africa, the one word you used was it was very fresh.
Yeah.
And I think I think on the Livy Dalton podcast, which is a great one, you mentioned crushability.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could explain to the listeners just why fresh and crushability is so important for you.
Absolutely. So there's to distill things down again into kind of simplistic terms, because frankly, wine has a tendency to get overcomplicated when it needs to not be that way.
Slightly bruised. It's like a slightly bruised red apple. No, a slightly bruised red apple skin.
That was picked on a fall day. Yeah. No, I get you.
We all do it, though.
We do. I mean, we inherently do. But, like, frankly, it can all be brought down to its most simple nature. There are two, in my mind, two styles or two kind of ways to look at wine. There's brooding, deep, complex, layered.
Okay? Yeah.
And then there's fresh, simple, pure, elegant.
Yeah.
There's combinations of both, okay? There's a trend globally, and personally for myself, I'm moving away from the super complex, deep, brooding wines as my everyday wine. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, that was everyone's everyday wine. We wanted complexity, depth, all of these things.
Yeah.
I personally and professionally think that there's more opportunity to explore the fresh, easy, yet, you know, yet pure and defined examples of wine, right? Simple is actually quite hard to do. To produce a wine that is really great value plus incredible flavor is rather tough, especially when you're not adding a bunch of oak or using specific yeasts or...
To hide the fruit, to hide the juice.
Or just to enhance, even, right? Like, I'm not saying these are bad things. I'm just saying, on one side of it, what we do with Pierce Pridham is we emphasize and we try to grasp the freshness and purity and youthfulness of the wine, as opposed to saying, you need to sit this down for 2-3 years and let that age and get into a space. The average amount of time people save their wines is about the time it takes to buy it at the store and bring it to your kitchen counter, right?
Yeah.
It's something like an hour and a half. We produce wines that are immediately available to drink. Like, sure, you can age them, but the freshness is a positivity. You go to Europe, you go to the Mediterranean, you go to California, you know, the food, the everything in these areas tends to be fresh and vibrant, especially during the summer and spring seasons. And we want to mimic that with our wines. We don't really need to do all that much because our winemaking partners, they already have that mentality.
Yeah.
But, you know, you won't find massive alcohol amounts in our wines. You won't find gratuitous or even any wood in our wines. We want that purity of expression, and that we've formed this scale, we call it the unofficial crushability index. When we're building our wines with our partners, we sit there, we taste through the wines, and if we get to the point where we can take a glass, drink it without even really thinking too much about it, that's a 10 on the crushability index.
Yeah.
We also don't want you to be inebriated after doing this, like directly so. We want you to be able to enjoy it, perhaps at the beginning of your meal, mid-meal, whatever, have two glasses as opposed to one, and feel good about yourself, and feel good internally as opposed to having something that might be really big and heavy, which there are times for that, right?
Yeah.
Just not our wines, right?
There's a time for Amarone, and there's a time for Beaujolais.
100%.
Yeah.
And so we focus on the wines. We enjoy European mentalities, not to say, like, I'd love to do something in California or Australia or something along those lines. And frankly, you're seeing a trend there with winemakers trying to retain freshness in their wines instead of extracting.
It's
cool.
It's funny. Like, you can feel the shift. Like in the 90s, and I'm not going to be the guy that blasts Robert Parker. Everyone does.
He was super important
in
a period of time.
Important.
Still is in a large way.
Yeah, but it's so funny. It's the en vogue thing. Oh, the Parkerization of wine.
Sure.
And this and that. But it was never just about him. But it seemed that, like, just, you know, late 80s, 90s, probably early 2000s, everything was just bigger. And
we enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was good.
I enjoyed the hell out of Big Shiraz, like, at the time. It was super, it's at the beginning of my wine studies. There's absolutely nothing wrong with any of that, right?
But then the shift is just, everything is lighter, lower alcohol is...
People also didn't like Beaujolais very well. Like, it was like kind of a laughing stock. I wouldn't say people didn't. I'd say wine professionals would be, you know, like Beaujolais Nouveau, blah, 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 right? They never really caught the significance of it being the first wine of the season. It's inexpensive and amazing. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It was a trend. So the pendulum is starting to swing. And you even see it with all your fairly available products, wines now on the shelves. Compared to 6, 7, 8 years ago, the alcohol has gotten lower. The oak use has definitely gotten lower. There is an emphasis on freshness now because people are realizing, and wine producers are realizing, this is important for getting people to consume more.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's just meant to be a food item. It's just,
it's
part of the table. You won in 2010 the BOSC, the Best Ontario Sommelier Competition.
That long ago.
I know.
I saw Jose yesterday, actually, out in who just won the most recent one.
Yes, he did.
A very talented, hardworking sommelier out in Hamilton at Hamilton Golf and Country Club.
Yeah, he's on my list. I've talked to him. I have my list of guests that I want.
Yeah.
And Jose is.
He's one of the. I've been fortunate to know him for a number of years, and he is a tireless, you know, self improver. And I'm really proud of how he was able to do that competition.
Yeah.
It is not fun while you're doing it.
No, and he has four children.
He's got a full time job. He takes himself very seriously, and he's always smiling.
Yeah, smiling.
He is always smiling. Yeah. So I don't know, man. That's something for us to look up to.
He's better than most of us.
Yeah. Totally.
So I just for the people, I'd love if you could just take us to 2010. What do you remember of, like, what did you have to do to win?
So 2010, I moved to Toronto in 2008, and that was from Windsor. I was working for Harris Casinos, got the job at Canoe, again, above my experience and pay grade. I think I was like 27 or something like that, or 20. I was pretty young, relatively speaking.
I
started pretty young. I started when I was 20-ish. And that being said, moving to Canada's capital, it's an intimidating place, not knowing a lot of people. And at the time, it was a burgeoning community. There was an old guard community that was quite small and still is active today. But that's when things started to really start to blossom and more people started to come. So this is like the beginning of a community that still stands today, and the pillars are still there and everyone's moved in places. So it's quite intimidating. I'm amongst peers that, if you find a photo of us, we all still know each other. And I didn't know what to expect. I remember practicing with an old colleague of mine from Windsor, who's a product consultant at the LCBO. I worked there for a little bit. And I remember doing mock service exams in their kitchen 2 days prior, and then hopping on a train, coming back to Toronto, and then doing this competition. I didn't really know much about it. Written exam, blind tasting, a service component. And you just kind of, there was very little context for this whatsoever. Right?
Yeah.
It hadn't been done too much. It was very much a Quebec-focused competition as well. The Quebecers have been doing this for quite some time. They're extremely good at it. So this is kind of new for Toronto. And I didn't know what to expect. I remember coming out of there, and I remember Sarah D'Amato, who's an amazing sommelier. She's the president of CAPS Ontario. She came up to me. She said, "You know what, Will, it was really great to meet you, and an excellent job and great effort." And I remember hearing it and hearing, like, oh, I lost. Like, that was like a congratulatory, better luck next time.
Yeah.
She had an amazing poker face when it came down to it. So I just kind of said, oh, well, you know what? It was a cool experience. There are peers here that have bested me at this thing. And it turned out that I ended up winning it. So it was a really amazing experience.
All right. So if your finger touches the label, that's a no-no for service, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, I couldn't imagine even trying to touch. Like, okay, there's a bunch of little.
Because I want to get into, like, just for service, all the things that you specifically, like, when you pour, the label must be showing to the customer, and you walk around clockwise.
Yeah.
And the, like, I talked about it in the first podcast when I did the certified level. Like, I got my diploma from WSET.
Yep.
But when I did my certified for the court, passed the tasting, passed the theory. And then I put the glass at the wrong spot. I put it on the left instead of the right. So then I felt I had it put it on the consistent. So I put it on the left for all of them. And then when I poured, the arm went right in front of the eye of the judge. And now my hand is shaking. And it was Niagara Falls. It was a cascade of sparkling. Some in the glass. A lot of it not in the glass. It was a disaster.
Yeah,
so I wanted to get to some of the specifics that you got to do.
All right. Let's first preface this by saying there is nothing realistic about the scenario relative to what actually happens in a service scenario. What it does is it does test some of your skills. It's not, I wouldn't call it hugely accurate. What it does is help build your confidence, perhaps. It is an old school kind of style of exam.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say that this is how everyone should act everywhere, but there is a formality. They want to ensure that you understand the formalities of service. If you are in that super traditional London-based restaurant environment. So some of the things, it's extremely precise. Like, how many napkins do you fold? Which way you do walk around? Where do you put the ice bucket? Are you going to decant? If you decant, how are you going to decant? Are you going to utilize a candle in order to ensure that you keep the sediment aside? Again, in realistic 2019 Canada views, these are things that are held to only a few restaurants that they would employ this. And even then, you would alter it slightly depending on the guest. But you need to know it, right? Before you run a marathon, you want to jog a couple times, I think. So that being said, there are some very specific things that you need to adhere to. Nerves play a huge part in how things go. I thought I failed my first advanced MS exam because I ran out of time. I was too busy talking as opposed to doing, and I was thoroughly depressed when that occurred. Fortunately, it wasn't enough points to lose, to not get it, but you know, it's one of these things. You do one thing wrong and then it gets in your head, and it's a nerves game in the end. And you can push that as far as you want. The competition is an it's that times 10 because you have an audience of your peers and others,
and
it's
all watching,
silent.
And we are whispering like, wait a minute, he didn't offer them water. Well, you know, and just like all the little things.
You do all of that. But I also think, having the perspective of being in that position before, I'd like to see anyone else put themselves on the line too and see how well they do, right?
Oh.
And you get to laugh about it afterwards. It's like, have the baby forget the pain.
Yeah.
And when you're all done, you're like, okay, that's fine. But leading up to it, you're losing. You're like, you've done it before.
Yeah.
You're losing your mind.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I get to kind of proctor occasionally these exams, or I'll come through as the maitre d' in the mock scenario. And I've been through these at national, international levels. I've done it in other languages. I'm pretty comfortable with the scenario now.
Yeah.
It took many years, but the first thing I do if a student is going into an exam and I'm there and I got to inspect them, I just give them, I say, take a deep breath.
Yeah.
You do this regularly, just go and do your thing and see what can happen, right? Because normally, most of the time, it's not a disaster.
No. Oh, no, but... Yeah, even now I'm getting a little bit of flashbacks from it.
Yeah, your heart rate goes up when you think about it, right?
Oh, yeah, because I didn't have a service background. I came from radio, you know, so, you know. So, yeah, you got you, by the way, again, congrats. You got the advanced.
Yep.
Which is super hard.
Yep.
What do you remember from that day, like your tasting? Do you remember any of the questions for written or what the wines were? I'm just wondering because I think... Because of the Somme movies and other things, people are now more interested in these competitions or interested in these exams. So I always like to ask if you have any specific moments that you remember, like you can take people, you know, from your point of view.
Sure. So for the advanced quartermaster sommeliers, I actually did mine in England, in northern England. It just turned out scheduling and being Canadian, we have the option to go both to the UK or the US. So I had to travel to a far off land to begin with. Would have had to do that to the States anyway. It's not my culture there. So there is a bit of an alienation there, but there's also a camaraderie. The big thing that I remember is the camaraderie of the individuals that you go through this with. Like, you've studied on your own, you're building your own confidence and knowledge base, and then you show up for a couple of days to experience with these other individuals from all around the world that have spent equal amounts of time. It's a shared experience, and you all get to meet each other in one place, and you all have similar jobs, easily passions and directions. So as far as tests, I'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah,
I think the context of the people that you get to meet and experience, these are some of the tightest friends that I have around the world. And that's something you can't trade up, right? That's something that comes with this as an aside that I think is something you take away regardless. As far as the test, I mean, the written test for the advanced theory was, at that level, I was solid with. It's written. I have a harder time with verbal theory. So for the MS exam, I haven't passed the theory component yet. If I was to write it down, I suspect I'd do just fine with it. But to verbalize it, it's one of my Achilles heels. And you'll find as you go down this path that you have certain things that you're better at and certain things that you need to work on. That's the point. Tasting component, I remember rifling through it and being very...
Do you remember the
confident?
Wines?
No, I don't remember the wines. I remember the setting. It's always the setting coming through. I remember going quite fast. I remember my instructor, Ronan Sabern, who's one of the top sommeliers in the UK, the world, frankly.
Yeah.
He was my examiner at the time. And just not really knowing what is going to come. The big thing was the service component, which is something that I did for a living, very confident with, was the thing that I felt I failed. And that was because I ran out of time. These are time scenarios. I started talking and then time done. And I just mentally, I remember crumbling. And then after that, I still had some scenarios to go through. So I just, in my mind, I'm like, you have to suck it up for the next few minutes and finish what you're doing. And what happened at that moment was all of my inhibitions disappeared because I already thought that it was done.
Okay, that's
so
interesting.
So I was cleared from all my neuroses, and I just went and did the thing and nailed everything else out, no problem, without a care in the world.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, it's already done. I may as well. It was an amazing psychological incident. So I don't remember so much questions or the wines. I remember the feelings and the emotions and the psychology, which has really helped me to better myself. So the tasting component, I passed the tasting for the MS. And now I feel so confident with that. I could not be right or wrong, whatever it is. But, I mean, I understand my psychology for that. Same thing with service scenarios.
Yeah.
Again, my Achilles heel is the theory. So someday I'll put that back to work when I have the time to do so.
On your website, and again, shameless plug, npwines.com.
That's Nick's website. That's Nick Pierce's website.
Oh, that's Nick Pierce's. Sorry, that's fine.
Yeah. Which is also, he's got all kinds of stuff for our wines and everything like that.
Yeah. Well, your company also, predom.ca. Yep. On the website, there's a section that says drink local, you know, on that one. And I'm just curious for you, how hard is it to sell Canadian wine to Canadians? Or more specifically, how hard is it to sell Canadian wine to Ontario?
It's a changing landscape. My very first co-production, if you will, my first foray into production was with Hinterland Wine Estates in Prince Edward County with Jonas and Vicky. This is in 2012. I was deep into competitions at the time, but I came from Windsor, which is Essex County, which is the wine region of Lake Erie North Shore.
Yeah.
And I had a firm belief that they could produce amazing quality Syrah from this area that was, if it was handled right. And so we collectively bought 1 ton of Syrah, fermented it, see what would happen. It turned out pretty amazing. It was inspiring enough to continue down this path, right?
Yeah.
And this is not a popular position. We took like an outlier of an outlier to an outlier to try to do this. And it opened up a number of doors and mental mindsets for myself. At the time when I started at Canoe, even earlier than that, one of the questions I was asked by a very good friend of mine who was my boss at the time, Bruce McAdams, was, what do you think about Canadian wines? This is 2008. And I said, you know, I'll be honest, I don't know much about it. And I'm applying for a job at a Canadiana restaurant at the top of the pyramid, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
And so I'll be honest, I don't know much. I know certain people. I worked for the LCBO, so I understand what's in there. I have bias that I want to change, though, because I see the potential. My original wine experiences started out in Western Canada, where the Okanagan was where I trained and studied, and they were advanced at the time as far as wine production is considered. So I saw potential, and something that I enjoy investing my time in is the things that have potential as opposed to things that are already here. So it used to be somewhat hard, maybe not in Canoe, to convince people to try Ontario wines as long as we did our job, but I got in at the right time where the Canadian wine industry or the Ontario wine industry really started to get interesting. And we were the first people that got to buy the best stuff that was coming out. So if we did our job, we were able to bring compelling, cool wines, which would then encourage those producers to make more compelling, cool wines. And this is a trend that is ongoing. So we are seeing more openness to it. We see more engagement. It is like steering the Titanic, you know, like it's going to take some effort. It still does.
Yeah.
But you know, myself and Nick have invested with Paul Pender, who's an amazing winemaker in Niagara, to produce some biodynamic Chardonnay. And the whole concept behind this is I'm incredibly proud of the Chardonnay and Cabernet Franc in particular that Ontario is doing, even though our Rieslings are awesome, our Pinots are awesome, our Gamays are awesome. Those two varieties, I think, when I travel internationally, and I do a lot, I want to be able to bring them something and say, hey, this is what Ontario tastes like.
Yeah.
Because everyone knows nothing about it.
Yeah.
And if they have heard of something about it, they have no context. So we said, let's build something really cool, something simple, something pure. Again, same sort of philosophy that if I bring it to, I'm going to Barolo next week amongst contemporaries and peers from all over Europe. I want to bring a bottle and say, this is what Ontario Chardonnay looks like. And it needs to stand up to the rest of the world's wines, which it inherently does. We have a bit of a confidence issue here.
But it's such a Canadian thing. It's like
looking for external approval.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
it's like our men and women, they're not celebrities until they make it into the United States. Now we recognize.
Until they're approved by someone else, right?
And then we're like, hey, they're ours.
Yeah, they made it. And in fact, like they've been doing it already here for some time.
Yeah.
I mean, Cave Spring has really led the charge since the 70s. And they haven't changed much. They're like, Vitis vinifera, like Euro-style wines. They get lost in the ether occasionally, but like I look at these things, I look at the wines that are available now, and I compare them to their counterparts, like professionally on the shelves, and I'm like, I'm getting great value here relative to a specific, you know, typeset. Like the inexpensive wines we can't compete on.
Yeah.
I think you can go to Chile, Argentina, these places that produce amazing quality, cheap wines, right?
Real estate's cheaper, labor's cheaper, so...
All the way around. Yeah. The economics are there. They have a more advanced logistics system to get things out. South Africa is another place that produces some very inexpensive quality juice. We have a hard time here in Ontario because it's higher cost of production, smaller production levels, but that mid-tier, you know, you start getting above $13 to $20, I would put so many wines and compare them internationally. When I go to the LCBO now, or to any store, I used to walk by the Ontario section or the Canadian section and be like, because I also had access to all this stuff. Now I stop and I grab at least three or four wines from that area that go into my cart along with all the international stuff. And I'm picky, you know? I'll drink just about anything. I'm also not that picky. But when it comes down to selection, I find, like, I compare globally. We got to start doing that here. And that's one thing that we haven't done yet.
All right. We only have a couple more minutes because we got this room till 12.
Yeah.
What tips would you give? You're talking about value. Someone's going to the LCBO. And, you know, when people ask me, I can't often give them a specific producer because I don't know what LCBO someone's going to, you know. But just in general, like for value wine, where's areas people should look for?
Well, I think you start off with your own mentality. Like write down or come up with a list of things that you normally drink that you like. And you're like, I default to this. This is what a lot of people do. It's like, I default to this because I know it fits and I might not know a lot about wine, which is cool. Start with that, right? So if you like Italian wines, great. You like California wines, great. That starts with two different mentalities. I look at Euro or New World, right? Old World, New World. If you like Old World style wines, start experimenting within the countries in there. In the Old World, I look at places like Portugal, Italy is still amazing value. South of France, a little bit of Spain. But like, I would start with countries and places there. Then dig down a little bit more, like reds, whites, whatever it is. I think the Douro Valley in Portugal is producing some amazing, amazing juice. The south of France, Languedoc and Roussillon, amazing juice for the dollar. Italy, you know, you go to Friuli, you go to Campania. These are great. In the New World, you know, as far as values there, again, start where you're at. South Africa, I mean, I'm biased, but they are producing some really compelling, beautiful wines at an amazing price. Where else in the New World? I think Pacific Northwest is producing some pretty cool stuff. California is turning the corner in that there was a homogenous kind of thing going on for a bit, at least on our shelves. I got to hand it also to the LCBO. You know, they've done what they absolutely can to continue to diversify their selection. So I'm finding more compelling wines, especially on the regular shelves that people tend to just ignore. And they're getting cooler. Like, they're doing their job. There's some fun stuff. Look at other countries that you can't read very easily, like Greece.
Oh, yeah.
Greece is an amazing place for really cool wines.
I don't think I've talked about it yet. Zinomavra, you can get like some good stuff that has some Barolo taste to it, 100%. You know, and it's going to be far cheaper than what you're going to get in Piemonte.
That being said, I mean, I'm a huge Piemonte. Like, as you move in and around, I would recommend that you find, like, 6 to 8 wines that you like that are all over the place. And if you don't, if you try 6 to 8 different wines from all over the world and you keep going back to the same wines, experiment within that area.
Yeah.
Because like, that's telling you that you like this. Don't try to, you know, fit a round peg into a square hole. If you like something for a reason, and then if you're compelled to a year from now, our tastes change. Sometimes they don't. You know, if you like California Chardonnay, drink California Chardonnay. I would say go check out Southern California, check out Santa Barbara. There's some amazing Chardonnays coming from there, and it kind of diversifies your pool, but you're still playing within the same one.
Yeah, it's funny that answer there also sort of my next one was advice to people that are intimidated about wine who want to get into it, but you kind of answered it there. Just, you know, get out of your comfort zone a little bit and just,
or play within your comfort zone.
Yeah,
right. So if you're like, I go to Fulinari Valpolicella all the time, that's my go-to wine.
Yeah,
nothing wrong with that. I drink like, there's tons of it on the shelf, right?
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's see what else is around there. Like, maybe check out another Valpolicella, something else from Italy. See what happens. Most countries have, like, almost a distinctive character to them, right? And if you want to experiment around it, awesome. If you like what you like, congratulations. It becomes a very expensive habit if you start going outside of your comfort zone and going upwards.
So, last question for you. Didn't even get into it. I wanted to talk about what was it like. I'll have to rope you in for another one because I want to ask you about pouring wine in Calgary when everyone was oil rich there. We'll save that. I'd love to go down that lane with you. But where do you see yourself? I mean, line cook at 14, resorts out west, canoe. You know, now making your own wine, your event company. Like, do you have any idea where you'll be in 5 years?
You know, I've got a family, so I've got 2 kids and a wife, and concentrating on that. The entrepreneurial aspect has been something I've been exploring for the last 6 years. You know, I'm very fortunate to work with some really great people And, you know, the production side is something that I'm finding extremely engaging. Mm-hmm. I also think it's starting to come to the time to start to give back to a certain degree. So meaning all of this is really fun figuring out the systems, but like it can't be for just for quote unquote profit. Mind you, there is no profit in the wine industry. So
yeah,
this is a passion project. But that being said, you know, travel and family are huge things right now. I think finding a way to turn that into to providing for those who don't have the same opportunities. You know, I'm quite fortunate where I'm at, and I don't want to lose focus of that. Now I have to be a role model to my kids. I also, you know, in the community, I'm not engaged as a sommelier. Really, I mean, I'm granddaddy now, you know, 6 years into it, which is a short lifespan. So if I can help to show a direction to those who are in the sommelier industry and wine business, that there are other options for you as you continue to go down your journey, that's a responsibility I want to take on, right? I don't know in the end. I have no idea where I'm going to be.
Yeah.
Hopefully all things keep going. Yeah, whatever. It's the, you know, it's the journey.
But at the same time,
it's been cool so far. Hopefully it keeps going. Everything stays healthy and forward moving. But we are in an exciting time. The wine has never been more exciting, diverse, or better than it is at this moment. Like every single day. It's an upward trajectory on everything.
Yeah.
And to be on this kind of wave, it's you know, 20, 30 years from now, hopefully I get to look back and go, wow, that was pretty cool. You know, that was a wild ride. So
it's a great answer. As we end this, promote one more time. Where can people find you, your wine, your services?
Sure. So contact Nicholas Pierce Wines or npwines.com. He's got, along with the Pierce Freedom Wines, he has his own familial wines under the Nicholas Pierce labels. And he's producing a few wines out of Prince Edward County through his family's farm there. Very small production, really cool juice. And then he's got over 100 other wines available for sale that are all unavailable at the LCBO. So,
yep.
I mean, like Nick and I, he's one of my business partners. He's one of my great friends. He's someone I admire and look up to. He's an incredibly hard worker. And he's very good at his job. So while it's that is his business, I'm incredibly proud to be part of this aspect, the fun part, mm-hmm. you know. And as far as getting our wines, you can get it through him. But more importantly, go out to the restaurants and support them. Right? Like they're the ones that are pouring ours, and they're the ones that are going out and working with, you know, the Nick Pierces of the world and all the other the wine agents that are, you know, working hard to bring you something cool. Go out and have a good meal. You'll get more value out of that too, right? Go support your local your restaurants.
And Predom.ca?
Predom.ca, so that's my events company. I work with Oregon Wine Board, do some speaking with Wines of South Africa. I've got the Indigena program through Vinitaly, which is a program by Ian Dagata, who is the world's foremost Italian grape wine expert. Basically, these are trade-centric seminars that we produce here in Toronto. We do some in Montreal, some in Edmonton. If you're in the trade, please go send me a message on my website at freedom.ca, and I will add you to the list, get you out to these amazing tastings. We just did Oregon last week. We had 37 wineries. We flew in 80 pounds of fresh Oregon Dungeness crab.
Oh,
yeah, it was super cool.
I was working. I couldn't go.
Oh, it was
so
wicked.
No, tell me it was
the
loud.
Wines were good. The food was amazing. No, the wines were absolutely awesome. But we try to do some really compelling things. You know, we rent streetcars to do wine bar tours.
Yeah,
we go a bit above and beyond the regular, you know, seminars. It's more experiential learning than anything, but it's all geared towards trade. We don't do too many consumer things. So if you're in the trade, I'm more than happy to invite you to these.
Will, really appreciate. I've been wanting to chat with you for a while. Big fan of the wines and just everything you're doing. I think it's fantastic. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the time, Matt. Appreciate being here.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, rate, review, subscribe. You can get this on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.